What if I told you that the speed of light, the ultimate unbreakable speed limit of the cosmos, is actually just, well, a completely arbitrary human invention?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds almost like science fiction, right? Or some kind of simulation theory.
Exactly. And what if, behind the scenes, the entire universe, every star, every planet, the gravity holding you in your chair right now, is actually being powered by a single simple math equation that's just solving itself on an endless loop?
It is a massive, potentially paradigm-shattering claim, especially regarding the single greatest unsolved mystery in modern science.
Right, which brings us to today's topic. Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are focusing entirely on the ultimate holy grail of physics, which is unification.
Yeah, the big one.
The huge one. For the better part of a century, the greatest minds in human history have thrown themselves at this problem. I mean, Einstein spent the last 30 years of his life just desperately trying to unify the fundamental forces.
He really did. He wanted to find a way to connect gravity, which, operates on these massive galactic scales, with electromagnetism, which governs the tiny microscopic world of atoms.
And it wasn't just Einstein. You had brilliant thinkers, Weyl, Schrodinger taking up the mantle later on. But the hurdle was always exactly the same.
Right, the scaffolding problem.
Yes. Every single time someone proposed a mathematical solution that seemed to stitch these forces together, they had to, well, they had to cheat just a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. To make the equations actually balance out, physicists had to invent something new that we couldn't actually see in nature.
Right.
So they'd have to bolt on extra dimensions, which is how we ended up with string theory. Or they'd propose entirely undiscovered gauge groups or hypothetical new fields,
Just adding layers and layers of invisible complexity to reality.
hoping that if we just added, one more dimension, the whole structure would finally just snap into focus.
Which brings us to our mission today. We are unpacking a super provocative new paper by physicist Eric McLean. It's titled Einstein and Maxwell Unified.
It's a fascinating read.
It really is. And McLean's central claim is that he has finally solved the question of unification, and not just unifying gravity and electromagnetism, but achieving the absolute pinnacle, unifying the smooth curves of general relativity with the jagged random jumps of quantum mechanics.
Which is an incredibly bold claim to make in modern physics.
It is. But here's the kicker, the reason we're actually deep diving into this today. He does it by adding absolutely zero new things to the universe.
Yeah, that's the part that really caught my attention.
No extra dimensions, no hidden particles, zero free parameters.
Right, because his core premise is that these seemingly incompatible forces, they were never actually separate things to begin with. They're just different geometric projections of a single algebraic operation.
Okay, let's unpack this, because if we want to understand how you can unify the forces of nature without inventing like 10 extra dimensions, we first have to understand the blueprint of reality that McLean is working with.
Right.
The paper starts with a mathematical structure called E8. Can you walk us through what that actually is?
I can certainly try, though E8 is notoriously difficult to visualize.
Fair enough.
It is this exceptionally beautiful, highly symmetrical mathematical structure, basically a root system that exists in 8 dimensions.
Okay.
And what McLean's paper details is that this complex E8 structure naturally breaks down or decomposes into two identical, highly intricate, four-dimensional geometric shapes.
And those are the 600 cells.
Exactly. Two 600 sets.
So if I'm picturing this for everyone listening, it's almost like a dazzling, multifaceted crystal.
That's a great way to think about it. Imagine two of these crystals, and each one has exactly 120 vertices or points on it.
Okay, two crystals, 120 points each.
Right. Now, McLean argues that the first 600 cell acts as the blueprint for matter. It mathematically encodes all possible quantum states.
So that's the physical stuff.
Yes. And the second 600 cell encodes geometry. This represents measurement or the observer's frame of reference.
So we have a crystal representing what the physical universe is, and a second crystal representing how the universe is measured. But they don't just sit next to each other in a void, do they?
No, and this is where the geometry gets really fascinating. These two crystals, they don't overlap completely. They aren't isolated either.
Okay.
Out of the 120 points on each crystal, they share exactly 24 vertices.
Only 24 points actually touch.
Only 24. McLean calls this the bridge. Mathematically, this specific intersection is known as the D4 root system.
So you have matter on one side, geometry on the other, and absolutely zero direct connection between them, except for this really specific 24-point bottleneck.
And that bottleneck dictates literally everything about the reality we experience.
Wow.
Because every single interaction between a particle of matter and the space-time it occupies, it has to mathematically squeeze through that bridge.
Right.
So MacLean calculates what he calls the transfer matrix across this bridge. And I know transfer matrix sounds, you know, super intimidating.
It does a little bit.
But it's really just the math of how much information can successfully pass back and forth through that 24-point intersection.
Okay, so what happens when he runs the numbers on that bottleneck?
Something astonishing, honestly. You don't get infinite possibilities or just chaotic static.
Mm.
The mathematics dictate that exactly 4 and only 4 non-zero channels of communication can emerge across that bridge.
4 channels. And the universe just happens to have exactly 4 fundamental forces. I have to imagine that's not a coincidence here.
It definitely isn't. When MacLean calculates the specific mathematical amplitudes, essentially the structural strength of these 4 channels, they map perfectly to the forces we observe in nature.
Like a one-to-one match.
A one-to-one match. The strongest channel has an amplitude of 36, and it carries a scalar geometry that maps perfectly to Einstein's field equations for gravity.
All right.
The next channel has an amplitude of 24. This is a vector geometry, and it gives us Maxwell's equations for electromagnetism.
Which totally covers the title of the paper, Gravity and Electromagnetism, born from the exact same intersection.
Yes. Then the third channel, with an amplitude of 12, gives us the Yang-Mills equations.
Yeah.
Those govern the strong nuclear force holding atoms together.
Right.
And finally, the fourth channel has an amplitude of 6. This provides what's known as the Cartan frame, which you can just think of as the geometrical scaffolding that the other forces act upon.
That is just, I love how elegant that is. A clean sweep of the fundamental forces all emerging naturally from the geometry of the E8 structure without adding a single extra dimension.
It really is beautiful math.
But wait, I have to ask a clarifying question here. If E8 has these 2 600 cells, and each one has 120 vertices, but only 4 channels of communication are active across the bridge, what is happening with the rest of the structure?
Oh, yeah.
Because the paper mentions that there are 74 other modes in this transfer matrix. What do they do?
Well, mathematically speaking, those 74 modes are null. They are completely decoupled. They don't transmit anything at all.
Okay, so think of it like this for you listening. Imagine you sit down at a massive, incredibly intricate grand piano that has 120 keys.
Right.
But when you start playing, you realize only 22 of those keys actually strike a string and make a sound. The other 74 keys you press and you just get, well, silence. Nothing happens.
I really like that analogy, actually. The forces of nature are essentially just the 4 chords that the universe actually plays.
Wow.
The rest of the internal mathematical machinery of reality is completely silent to us.
Wow.
And this is a profound insight into why our universe appears, you know, relatively simple and orderly to us.
Because we only hear the 4 chords.
It's exactly. For decades, physicists have treated gravity, electromagnetism, and the nuclear forces as 4 separate, distinct inventions of nature that we need to somehow stitch together with a unifying thread.
Right.
But MacLean's saying that the forces aren't separate inventions at all. They are just the 4 active keys on the exact same piano.
But this immediately brings up the biggest, most glaring problem in modern physics.
The hierarchy problem.
Yes. Because if we look at those birth amplitudes you just mentioned, gravity is born at an amplitude of 36. Electromagnetism is born at 24.
Yeah.
That's a ratio of 3 to 2. They are practically siblings born at the exact same time with roughly the same structural strength.
They are very comparable at the point of origin, yes.
But in the observable universe, the reality you and I actually live in, gravity, is astonishingly weak. It is 10 to the power of 36 times weaker than electromagnetism.
It's a massive discrepancy.
Just to put that in perspective for the listener, you can pick up a paperclip with a tiny, cheap fridge magnet, and that tiny little magnet is entirely defeating the gravitational pull of the entire planet Earth.
Yeah, gravity gets overpowered instantly.
Right. So if they're born essentially equal in this mathematical bridge, how does the paper explain gravity becoming so incredibly weak?
Right. So MacLean solves this through a concept called confinement. And to understand it, we have to look closely at that 24-point bridge again.
Okay.
That bridge forms a highly symmetrical boundary between the matter crystal and the geometry crystal. Now, remember the types of channels. Electromagnetism operates on a vector channel.
Right, a vector.
And by definition, a vector has a direction. Points somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It distinguishes a positive charge from a negative charge.
Okay, so it's like a car trying to drive north.
Good, let's use that. Imagine that car is inside A perfectly spherical, completely symmetrical room.
Okay.
Every wall looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
There are no landmarks. In a room with perfect symmetry, there is no north. There is no up or down or left or right.
Right?
Because the car requires a direction to move, but the room offers absolutely no direction, the car is stuck.
It can't go anywhere.
Exactly. Electromagnetism faces the exact same problem. When its directional vector tries to cross the perfectly symmetrical boundary of the bridge, it can't pick a direction, therefore it gets trapped.
Oh, wow.
It stays confined inside what MacLean calls the cage of the proton. And because it never crosses the boundary, it never pays a toll to escape. It retains its full, original, massive strength.
Okay, here is where it gets really interesting. Because gravity, on the other hand, operates on the scalar channel.
Yes.
And a scalar is fundamentally different from a vector. It has no direction. It has no charge. It has no preference. It just is.
Right. So to go back to your room analogy, if a vector is a car looking for north, a scalar is like a gas filling the room.
Okay.
It doesn't care about north or south. It just expands outward in all directions.
So because it doesn't need to pick a direction, gravity doesn't get trapped by the perfect symmetry. It can literally leak through the boundary of the cage.
It does leak out.
Yeah.
But escaping that cage comes with a massive thermodynamic cost.
The toll booth.
Exactly. MacLean calculates the exact mathematical toll that the symmetrical boundary extracts from the scalar signal as it oozes through.
Okay, and what is that toll?
Well, the gravitational signal is screened by all those confined modes bouncing around inside. Mathematically, it pays a cost represented as the fine structure constant alpha to the 18th power multiplied by 12 over 7.
And when you run that specific calculation, it outputs a signal attenuation of roughly 1.24 times 10 to the power of 36.
Down to the decimal, it matches the observed weakness of gravity in our universe perfectly.
I really want that to sink in for everyone listening right now. Gravity is not naturally a weak force. Deep down in the architecture of the universe, gravity is actually slightly stronger than electromagnetism.
Yeah, 36 to 24.
It's just the only force that lacked the directional charge needed to stay trapped safely inside the proton. Gravity is the only force that found the exit, and the journey out exhausted almost all of its energy.
It is a stunningly elegant solution. I mean, it answers the why of the hierarchy problem without needing to invent some mysterious new particle to carry a weak gravitational signal.
Okay, so we've established the geometry, the piano keys, the forces, the bridge, and the confinement cage that makes gravity weak.
Right.
But this brings up a giant question for me. A piano doesn't play itself. A crystal doesn't vibrate on its own. What is actually powering this entire system? Like, who is pressing the keys?
That is the crucial next step, because you're right. A static mathematical geometry doesn't do anything. It doesn't create a living universe.
Right.
So MacLean traces the entire system back to a single foundational axiom. It is an equation so simple that it almost seems impossible. It's just sigma equals 1 over 1 plus sigma.
Wait, that is just basic algebra.
Yeah.
How does a simple fraction create physical reality? I mean, I need you to explain how we get things like heat, entropy, and time out of that.
It's all about iteration. That equation isn't a static string of numbers. Because the equation references itself. You know, sigma equals a fraction containing sigma.
Mm.
It creates a continuous feedback loop.
Okay.
It solves itself, takes the answer, plugs it back in, and solves itself again, infinitely.
Like aiming a camera at a television screen showing the camera's feed.
Yes, exactly. An infinite regression. Now, every time that specific algebraic equation iterates, the resulting value gets slightly smaller. It mathematically contracts.
Okay.
And in thermodynamics, a system continuously contracting is fundamentally indistinguishable from a system giving off heat. So this mathematical contraction acts as a physical heat exchange.
Wait, so the math iterating literally generates the concept of heat?
Yes, and it generates temperature too. As this feedback loop runs, the system settles into certain fixed frequencies, known mathematically as eigenvalues.
Okay, let's unpack eigenvalues for a second, because that's some heavy jargon.
Yeah, fair enough. Think of striking a large brass bell. When you first hit it, it produces a chaotic cacophony of sound.
Right, lots of noise.
But very quickly, that chaos settles into a few pure dominant tones that ring out clearly. Those pure unchanging cones are the bell's eigenvalues.
Oh, okay.
When MacLean's equation loops, it acts like striking a mathematical bell. It settles into fixed mathematical tones. By counting the possible states of those tones, what physicists call a partition function, the math naturally generates the concept of temperature.
And when you have heat exchange and temperature,
you get the fundamental law of thermodynamics. It perfectly aligns with the Clausius relation, which states that the change in heat equals temperature multiplied by the change in entropy.
Wow.
It's pure algebra, perfectly generating the laws of thermodynamics.
So the entire universe, all the entropy and heat and time we experience, is basically just the exhaust fumes of that one tiny equation endlessly looping?
Essentially, yes.
And this brings us back to my very first question at the top of the deep dive. Because if this engine is purely mathematical, it completely redefines how we view the speed of light.
It absolutely does.
If reality is just this math looping, what actually is c?
Well, we are taught in school that the speed of light, c, is exactly 299,792,458 meters per second.
Right.
We treat it as a hard-coded physical speed limit of the cosmos. But MacLean shows that this number is completely arbitrary.
Because it's based on human measurement.
Exactly. It's a human invention made by a committee that arbitrarily decided how long a meter should be, based on a platinum bar stored in a vault in France.
So if we didn't invent the meter, what is the true nature of light speed in this theory?
In the pure mathematical reality of MacLean's axiom, mass and energy are the same thing. Mass is just those fixed tones, the eigenvalues we talked about, frozen in place, standing still. Energy is the frequency of those tones moving. Therefore, in Einstein's famous E equals mc squared, c isn't a speed measured in human meters.
Right.
C is just the mathematical time it takes for the axiom self-reference to complete one full loop. And c squared is the amplitude of that self-reference completing a round trip. It is the math looking at itself in the mirror and the reflection traveling back.
That is just mind-bending. But it sets up perhaps the most difficult conceptual shift in the entire paper.
The nature of space-time.
Yes. Because if the universe is just geometric information driven by a thermodynamic math loop, what is space-time? We need to talk about the box.
We do. Back in 1995, the physicist Ted Jacobson published a famous proof showing that Einstein's equations of general relativity actually emerge naturally from thermodynamics.
Right, which was a massive breakthrough.
It was, proving that gravity is just a macroscopic thermodynamic effect. But it left a lingering, obvious question. If space-time has thermodynamics, if it acts like a gas of heat and entropy, what are the molecules of that gas? What is empty space actually made of?
And MacLean answers Jacobson directly. He says the molecules of space-time are protons.
Exactly.
To be precise, the protons are those 600 cells with their fixed mathematical tones. But I really have to push back here because this fundamentally breaks how our brains are wired to perceive the world.
It's very counterintuitive.
Yeah. I want to read a quote directly from the paper because it highlights this beautifully. MacLean writes, "We evolved to throw rocks at animals. Rocks exist in space. Space is a box. The box is there whether or not the rocks are, except it is not."
Yeah.
Explain why I need protons for empty space to exist.
It is a profound unlearning of our deep primate intuition. We view the universe as an empty container, a giant void.
Right, like an empty room.
We assume God or the Big Bang came along and sprinkled stars and planets and people into the empty box.
Mm.
But MacLean is showing that space-time is relational.
Relational, okay.
Think of a giant complex web of string. The knots in the string are the protons. The space isn't a box holding the knots. The space is the tension of the strings connecting the knots.
So if you theoretically removed all the knots,
the whole web vanishes. Space-time is literally just the configuration space of proton states. It's the mathematical relationship between the matter.
Wow.
If you removed all the matter from the universe, space-time wouldn't just be an empty void. Space-time itself would cease to exist. There's no stage without the actors.
So if space-time is just a web of relationships, how does this finally achieve the ultimate goal? How does it unify Einstein's smooth, continuous macrogravity with Schrodinger's jumpy, probabilistic microquantum mechanics? Because this is the 80-year wall in physics.
Well, MacLean argues that they were actually never incompatible.
Really?
Yeah. The conflict was an illusion caused by us looking at the exact same mathematical object from two different distances.
Okay, explain that.
The mathematical statistical manifold generated by the looping axiom forces a very specific shape, known as the Fisher-Rao metric.
Let's explain that simply. What is a Fisher-Rao metric?
Simply put, the Fisher-Rao metric is a way to measure the distance between probability distributions. It's the map of statistics, how far apart two statistical guesses are.
Okay.
Now, there is another metric in physics called the Fubini study metric, which measures the distance between pure quantum states.
Okay, so one is about statistical probabilities, the other is about quantum mechanics.
Precisely. And what MacLean proves mathematically is that under the rules of quantum probability, specifically something called the Born rule, the Fisher-Rao metric and the Fubini study metric become identical. They are the exact same mathematical shape.
So they are the exact same thing, just viewed through different lenses.
Yes. Einstein's general relativity emerges when you zoom way out and look at the thermodynamic limit of this shape, how heat flows across horizons on a massive macroscopic scale.
Okay.
Schrödinger's quantum mechanics emerges when you zoom all the way in and look at the geodesic limit, how individual points move along the fine details of that exact same shape.
So what does this all mean for the greatest mystery in quantum mechanics? The measurement problem.
Right.
You know, the famous Schrödinger's cat idea, where a quantum state exists in a blurry superposition of all possibilities until a conscious observer looks at it and then it magically collapses into a single reality. Do we still need human consciousness to collapse reality in this model?
MacLean dissolves the mystery entirely by bringing us right back to where we started today. The two 600 cells.
The blueprint of matter and the blueprint of measurement.
Exactly. The first cell is the quantum state, the blur of possibilities. The second cell is the measurement geometry.
Right.
There's no magical, mystical collapse caused by a human mind. The act of observation is simply information crossing the 24-point bridge between those two cells. The bridge acts as a mathematical projector. It projects the four-dimensional quantum state down into a three-dimensional measurement slice.
Oh, that makes so much sense. It's like shining a flashlight on a 3D object, like a coffee mug, and looking at the 2D shadow it casts on the wall.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
The coffee mug didn't magically collapse or fundamentally change just because you looked at its shadow. You were just viewing a lower dimensional projection of it.
Exactly. The measurement problem and quantum gravity aren't two separate mysteries. They are the exact same mechanism. The same mathematical transfer matrix that produces the four fundamental forces is what translates a quantum probability into a measured physical reality.
It is breathtakingly elegant. MacLean calls this framework pentagon physics, referencing the deep five-sided geometric angles at play in the root systems.
Yeah.
And the implications are staggering. He is saying mathematics doesn't just describe physics. It isn't just a convenient language humans invented to roughly sketch what reality is doing. The mathematics is the physics.
It is. And what's vital for any theory that claims to be a unified theory of everything is that it must be falsifiable.
Right. We need to test it.
This isn't just elegant philosophy. MacLean includes very specific kill conditions in the paper. This isn't a theory that can just be tweaked infinitely to fit new data if experiments prove it wrong.
Give me an example of a kill condition.
Kill condition one. If particle physicists ever definitively discover a fifth fundamental force, this entire unification theory dies on the spot.
Oh.
Because, as we discussed, the transfer matrix mathematically only allows exactly four non-zero channels across the bridge. If there's a fifth force, the core geometry of this theory is fundamentally wrong.
That level of scientific rigor is what makes this deep dive so compelling. It's a complete paradigm shift, overturning a century of how we view space-time, but it is grounded in strict, unforgiving mathematical boundaries.
It forces us to completely rethink our relationship with the universe.
It really does. And I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over tonight, building off the concluding insight of MacLean's paper. We established that the foundational axiom, that tiny equation endlessly looping and powering the universe, doesn't actually know anything about fundamental forces or gravity or particles.
Right.
It only knows one thing, self-reference. Mm-hmm. It is literally just a mathematical loop looking at itself.
The forces we experience are just what that pure self-reference looks like from the inside.
Right. So if the fundamental building blocks of all reality, the very space and time we occupy, are just pure abstract self-reference projecting itself outward into geometry, what does that make human consciousness?
That's the big question.
When you look out at the stars tonight, consider that you aren't a tiny biological creature sitting inside an empty box called the universe. You might just be the universe's math, temporarily folded up into a specific, incredibly complex shape that allows it to finally, consciously, look back at itself.